So what would it mean for us to really know, to really trust, to really deeply understand that what it is that we fundamentally are is profoundly wholesome, precious, worthy of cherishing, nourishing, supporting in order to even more fully develop and express that which is true at the heart of it all, but not always manifesting on the surface of things, on the surface of things. Part of what we need to attend to in this territory is those things that make it hard for us to know that, to trust that. And in terms of the Buddha's teachings, we're pointed in many different ways, but again and again back to seeing how we form views that are not in accordance with how it is, that are perhaps unquestioned, that are perhaps passed to us by other people who were given those views by other people who had those views, who were given those views, and it just keeps getting passed on until someone stops and says, is that true? Let me check it out and see. So not being told to have a different view, but to look and see what are the views I have and whether they actually accord with the reality of our experience. Bearing in mind that when we're looking through a view, whatever the view might be, we'll tend to see the things that confirm it, and we'll tend to not see the things that challenge it, because we tend to hold quite tightly to the views as a form of security. And views about ourselves are fundamental to this, in this process, the views we have about ourselves, and particularly and tragically those that don't fully acknowledge, recognize and honor the preciousness, the beauty, the nobility of this that we are. This isn't to say there isn't, of course, plenty of things that are other than that. But mostly we're quite good at recognising and identifying those, and most of us have probably spent a lot of time in our lives working on them, trying to fix them, sort them out, and maybe come to recognise that that doesn't seem to do it. One of the interesting principles of the Buddha's teaching is that when we come from a certain place, whatever we do ends up reflecting that place. It's part of what we call the principle of karma, but it's also the way things work. So if we come from a view that says there's something not okay about me, I need to fix it, everything I do trying to fix it will be simply coming out in a way that confirms there's something wrong with me, because I've been acting on the view. And if I act on a view, I strengthen it. No matter the outcome of the action, having acted on a view, it becomes stronger within me. So even if I fix the thing that I thought was wrong with me, having succeeded at that because I believe something was wrong with me, I will go on to find something else that's wrong with me and now have to fix this. Does anyone recognize that pattern? You don't have to put your hands up. Just let yourself know if you do. I can put my hand up because I'm in the hot seat here. It's allowed. Yeah. So I haven't organized some of the ideas I want to bring here as well as I sometimes would have done, but I'm at the same time happy to be bringing them. So it's perhaps useful for us to contemplate something that my wife Catherine, who many of you will know and who teaches here and elsewhere, she reflected after reading in a book that was looking at, in a way, the development of human cultures, philosophies, spiritualities, religions across the globe and throughout the ages. And it made a startling observation at one point, and it said, and it referred, I'll just just give a little context to the observation. It referred to the Judeo-Christian creation myth. And you might have a sense of where we're going here when I say that. The Garden of Eden and all of what went on between Adam and Eve with the trees, the apples, the snakes, and whatever else was going on out there. And the conclusion it came to was, this was the first time in human history that someone was to blame for suffering. Before that, that wasn't the way it was seen. And of course, things were difficult, painful, not as we wished. But actually, it was somebody's fault now. They'd messed up bad. And of course, there were consequences that involved somewhere hot. For those of us who grew up in a culture that comes from both a kind of the probably the Greek ethical philosophy that translated through the Judeo-Christian sort of religious ethic of a God who, if you look at it, turns out to be angry, jealous and vengeful quite a bit of the time in terms of what goes on. It's all right if he's on your side. It's a he, interestingly enough. That's probably part of the whole dynamic. It's a very masculine orientation and part of a patriarchal structure that infuses our culture. But part of the way it plays out for us is that we tend to think it's our fault that things are the way they are. We tend to often have a sense of loss of or undermining of a sense of our inherent value. Because we've been told, well, the original condition is not that. Original sin, I think, is the term we all know. Now, that's not a concept you necessarily find in other cultures. Of course, because this Western culture has been so dominant in our world, it's managed to infiltrate a lot of other cultures that didn't really have it like that. So it's not universal, but it's out there. Most places we look. And it started, isn't that interesting to think? It started, as opposed to it was always there. In that form, at least, it started. The first time, suddenly, someone was to blame for this. Someone was wrong. Someone was bad for all this. That's not easy for us. Sometimes when I reflect, and I do this with real respect for those traditions, there's a lot of wisdom and a lot of good heart in the Judeo-Christianic tradition, absolutely. But when I look at the model of the angry, jealous, vengeful God, I do think that it's not a great role model for our kids. You know, and we're them. It's a role model we've sort of been given. And this isn't, I hope it doesn't sound like I'm having a go at someone else's tradition, because Buddha Dharma has within it plenty of difficult material where it's not very conscious of its own limitations and shadows. And I wouldn't pretend for a moment that wasn't so. And I still love the Buddha Dharma. So, but seeing that has a profound significance for me in reflecting on this topic, because it's like it's part of our cultural story. It's part of an identity that we have that isn't yours or mine, although we partake of it. It's ours. And it's so wide and pervasive that we don't see it, because we're swimming in it. And it's really hard to work with it in ourselves when we're swimming in it with everyone else. So we need to name it a little here. And I don't know in my saying that much about it whether it's kind of clear enough. I hope it might be. It's not making sense to everybody. No. I probably can't be surprised at that. I'd have to speak for quite a long time to unpack that fully. So I'm kind of offering it. And if it doesn't land or resonate for you, it's fine to say, that guy up the front maybe didn't know what he was talking about that day or any day. It happens, for sure. But So there's a cultural context we're working in, and it's part of what makes sense of why, for instance, as I said earlier, His Holiness the Dalai Lama was surprised to discover the primary relationships his Western students had with themselves and actually the people they were closest to, like their parents. It's a culture in which a lot of judgment and rejection is played out, in which the actions that might be unskillful are identified with and associated with defining who you are and your value. And as a result, having all made mistakes and messed up and done things we feel sorry for or about regret, or have been told by others they weren't very happy about, quite a lot in fact, that latter I expect, we've probably done our own little bit of telling other people about the things they did we weren't so happy about. And the message that kind of gets carried in that is the sense of there's something wrong with you. Not just you did something that was harmful, but there's something wrong with you. And that's a conclusion about self that is more than the action, even unskillful, if it was so, warrants us forming. Does that make sense? We might have done something. We see a child do something foolish, grab some biscuits in the supermarket. Poor kid, it's just walked down a 100-meter aisle with 1,000 packets of yummy sweet things. And in the end, it grabs one. And the parent says, "Don't do that, you bad child." Is that true? No, it's like, you poor child, and yeah, you can't grab it and rip into a packet of biscuits in the supermarket. The action is not going to be good here. But it's kind of understandable, and it certainly only says that this kid is maybe hungry, maybe bored, maybe just wants some biscuits. I can relate to that. Yeah? And so there's a difference there between an identity that's been given to the being and an acknowledgement that the behaviour is not in this moment and condition suitable. And that at home, when it's your biscuits and someone said, "Would you like a biscuit?" and gave you a packet of biscuits, it would be fine to rip open the packet and have a biscuit. And the distinction is a bit hard between those two things when you're only five. At some level, there's a lot of areas we're still only five in our lives. We're still learning. So seeing that, there's one thing there to be able to get clear about the views we carry about ourselves. And then also to back up, and because although the myth of the Garden of Eden was apparently the first time we became to blame for this condition, there's a kind of a deeper underlying thing that it picks up on and makes into a conscious, intentional culture, but that underlies it and is why it has power for us. And in our development, whether or not something happened before we began our earliest development, i.e. whether it all started at some point with conception or whether it started somewhere before that, but starting from there, basically this little being that's initially just A and then a small group of cells is sitting in a soup of chemicals. That's it. At a basic level, it's a little porous thing. Few cells, then quite a few cells, then actually quite a few cells. I'm talking billions eventually, and while it's still quite small, it's sitting in a soup of chemicals. That's how pretty much all life begins, how the first cells began, sitting in a soup of chemicals. And when the chemicals are surrounding it, nourishing, nutritive, supportive, it feels good. It supports and nourishes you, and the sense is goodness, goodness, goodness. When the chemicals are in any way toxic or poisonous around it, it feels bad, and the feeling is bad, 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 bad. These are primary experiences that we all had long before we had a clue we were having them or had any language for saying them. Does that make sense, what I'm saying there? We can understand that. It's a biological event or process that happens for every being, and that happened for every being back when beings never got past being a small clump of cells or just one of them, sitting in a soup full of either nourishment or toxicity. And our early environments involve us learning to relax and open and absorb things when it's nourishing, and to tighten and contract and try not to absorb it when it's toxic. That's how we survive. Okay? We don't have any conceiving at that point, and neither do sort of single-celled organisms in the ocean or in puddles of warm water being sort of infiltrated by sunlight, which is the sort of the current scientific biological idea of creation. Somehow some molecules got together and formed cells in sunshine, and it's, to my mind, not better or worse than the one that involves two fingers going bzing, and this one lights up. Slightly more simplified, but not that different. In that situation, there's no real ability to recognize what's going on. And what becomes wired into us is a association between pleasant, which is giving me survival, and good. And unpleasant, which is harmful and dangerous to me, and becomes bad. And there's a step that's made in that. Good because I want and need it, bad because it's threatening and dangerous to me. And because the only thing that's here is this, and this is undifferentiated, undivided. Without thinking it's me, the sense is this is me, because there's nothing else. Me, mum, the world, if we're in an embryo, sorry, in a uterus, or if there's some other way it happened, then in that way. And so basically when it feels good, I'm good. When it feels bad, I'm bad. Because we have no other way to handle it. We don't think that, but that is the actual experience. That's the energetic experience. That's the reality of it for us. And so we carry this very early imprint of the sense of I'm bad. And it doesn't take much for us to decide, oh, that's the real version. Because that's what then happens when the culture orients us that way. Does that make sense? Did you follow how I've kind of tried to link the early developmental experience within the cultural phenomena of our inheritance, we can say, that we all are part of? And so then the conclusion is, and the tendency is because the view is that way, is we tend to pick up what accords with the view. And strangely, it makes us feel safe, because I know who I am and where I fit. Even though that's bad and I have no place to go, at least I know it. Gosh, imagine if that happened not to be true. Imagine if that wasn't the case. What might we imagine or conclude about what it is that we are in those terms? In terms of value, in terms of preciousness. Isn't it blindingly obvious if we encounter a small baby? We don't necessarily always feel love. Sometimes they're noisy and screaming and smelly and messy. If we're parked beside them on a long-haul flight, it might be, you know, hell. But more so for them, usually, than for us. But actually, if we can pause in a moment of openness with a newborn child or a young infant before they've got a personality and any ability to demand things too much from us going on. We've always got some personality, but it's not been solidified yet. Isn't it something obvious that there's something precious here? Don't we recognize that? Don't we love that? Now, there's a phrase I remember from my wife's mum, who died last year, and she was a lovely woman, Anna McGee. And she used to say something like, babies are born trailing clouds of grace. It's like from her Catholic perception, that sense of like they're carrying something with them. It's like they're closer to something which we understand. We could call grace, we could call purity, we could call it a fundamental sacredness or holiness or beauty or just goodness. If we understand that as not in opposition to badness, but as an, oh yeah, something wholesome, beautiful, lovely, worthy of caring for. And so noticing, perhaps, taking a moment to notice where hearing these reflections leaves you, where it brings you, what it might touch, what, and you might say, no, what's he going on about? That's all right. I can have those responses too when I step back and listen to myself sometimes. No. I try not to step too far back or I get lost, but a little bit of space, does this make sense for me? But what's it like to hear that we name something? I hope I'm managing to name something you recognize or have some sense of. Certainly my wish. But if you don't recognize it, then trust what your experience is. That's always the best way to go about things, and see what it says to you in this territory. So there's a view that's there, that's backed up by early experience and reinforced by selective attention in later experience, that easily leaves us without a really clear and steady access to a sense of value, of appreciation for this being. And therefore with considerable obstacles towards understanding what goes even deeper than that basic sense of something kind of precious or lovely we might ascribe to an infant more easily than to the complicated and messy human adult that we are. But that goes really to the fundamental nature of what's here, that we are part of, that we are, you could say. But that isn't what necessarily we see on the surface of things. So to actually trust our fundamental human goodness, I think is essential. I think is an incredible offering into the world, because it actually also expresses a trust in everything and everybody else's. Because what it is that is fundamentally wholesome and good is mutual and shared, not owned by us individually. Can't be. And yet, if I look on the news, or read a newspaper, or just look around me, or even look inside me and see what my mind does and my feelings do, sometimes I think, I'm not sure that backs that up. Sometimes it's full of greed and selfishness. Sometimes it's full of irritation and anger. Sometimes it's disregard for other people or situations. Sometimes it's desperate wanting to have it my way. Huh? How does that come to be? Doesn't that seem to reinforce that actually we aren't so great? And I'm not trying to say that somehow everything we see arising in us is in its expression something wholesome, because many things aren't. But it's very much my understanding and my wish, what I want to articulate, is that where it ultimately arises from at the heart of it is wholesome. And so, just a couple of pieces to try and illustrate that. We are used to thinking in terms of attributing a portioning of blame for things to the causes that are at fault, whether it's someone else or myself. In Buddha Dharma, we don't really look at it that way. We understand causal relations, conditions, that don't select individual entities as either the cause or the effect, or neither the cause of or the subject of what's happening, but as a way of handling and talking about the process. What we see is there's actions and results, if we look at it. And certain actions coming from kinds of intentions lead to suffering. And other kinds of actions coming from different sort of intentions lead to well-being. And whether we want to speak in terms of there being an actor associated with those actions, we can or not. It doesn't really matter too much. It's hard to pin down what we mean by that. We can't find something fixed to make into that. But we don't have to say there's no one doing it, or there's someone doing it. The middle way is actually between those two. But it's where we find ourselves, in the action. And for me, there was a profound resolution of a deep distress of my early life, because I could see people doing all these things that seemed to be harmful. And I could see myself doing these things that were, if not harmful, sometimes quite selfish, which is harmful in its own way. And it seemed to be in contradiction with some sense I had that actually, but isn't there something of goodness here in us and me? At least I wanted to believe that. The world didn't seem like a place I'd really want to inhabit if it wasn't the case. And I met someone in the beginnings of my travels who pointed out to me, she said, you know, not everyone can see what you see. This is true for all of us, for you too. Not everyone can see what you see. Without you having even told me what you see, I know and I can tell you for sure, not everyone can see what you can see. And there'll be some things you can see that I can't. And there might be some things I can see that you won't easily be able to. But not everyone can see what you can see. And most of what's playing out is because of blindness. And this is what the Buddha pointed to as the core issue at the heart of the process that leads to suffering. Blindness. Avidya. Sometimes translated as ignorance, which is great because it gets it right back into our pejorative, judgmental, you're obviously stupid kind of paradigm. And we need to pick it up from that and say, no, avidya. A negating vid, seeing, same root. Although it's Pali, the Indo-European languages carry some literal equivalents, vid, to see. Vi, vipassana, to see. Video, to watch. Vision, to see. Avidya, not seeing. If we don't see what's going on, yeah, we can cause a lot of destruction. But it doesn't mean we're bad, it means we're blind, because we've not been shown how to see. And these teachings and practices are basically your bottom line toolbox for seeing. That's what we learn here. And why we need to learn it is because if we don't see, we just keep blundering into our life as a blind person, you know, in a china shop filled with sharp things. We break things and we get pierced all the time because we can't see. I hope that's not too graphic an image. It feels a bit ouch when I think about it, but that's what came out. So when I look carefully, and this is something I find myself coming back to again and again and doing again and again as a practice, and I've spoken about it here and some of you have heard me speak about it, but I feel very passionate about it, so I come back to it. When I look carefully at my experience, and I trust the same would be there for you if you did so, the things I've done in my life that I would look at it and could call bad, where I was hurtful, insensitive, cruel, selfish, greedy, or just disinterested in things in a way that has hurt other people or myself. If I look carefully at those times, and I can give you some examples, I don't know if I need to here, but if I look at those things, I can see that at the core of it in myself, what was happening, I couldn't see it when it was happening usually, that's why it happened, but what I can see is that I was in pain. I was afraid I was going to lose something I needed, not get something I wanted, going to be subject to some kind of deprivation. And in the fear and the need, these primary biological driven things of fear and need, don't get eaten, get some food. How to do that? Don't get eaten, fear. Get some food, greed. And everything ripples out from that. In those movements, caught in the identification with me and my need, me and my fear, not seeing the impact of the behavior on another, I did things which now, when I think about them, I feel really sad. I feel regret and remorse. And when I was younger, I felt profound guilt and a sense of, wow, I'm really bad. But that's no longer there because I don't see that as the truth of it at all. It's like, wow, I was really blind and I was really suffering. And then I did that. And you know, I'm confident that anything and everything that you have done in your life that you might feel sorry about or regret came from similar places. Whether or not you can see that And I'm not trying to convince you of this. I'm just telling you where I'm sitting when I look at you and speak to you. It's come the same way. And likewise, in the horrific expressions of greed and hatred that we can see playing out in our world currently and can track through its history, it's the same thing. And the bottom line, it always comes, because not just is there blindness, need, and fear. And the need and fear are valid because, of course, if you don't get food, you die. If something eats you, you die. But why is that important to us? Because actually we care. We care. We cherish. It's precious, this. We want to keep it alive. Otherwise, we wouldn't care. And we wouldn't do those things. It's only because we care that we ever did anything that hurt anybody. It's actually only because we care we ever did anything full stop, actually. If we didn't care, nothing would happen. Everything moves from that. Now what the Buddha recognizes is that caring isn't enough. We need wisdom to go with it. Caring is inherent. It's innate. It's right there. But it needs wisdom to go with it. And so this tradition is a wisdom tradition, we call it. Not because it doesn't value love, but because at a certain level, that's inherent and available. Wisdom is not. Wisdom needs to be learnt and developed. And if one sees that it's because I care, what is it we get angry about? Isn't it things we care about? Where someone or something we care about is being hurt or harmed or deprived? What is it we get needy about? Isn't it something that we feel is really important for the welfare of something we care about? Me or someone else? We get greedy or selfish and even disregard whether others have enough because this one needs to have enough? We wouldn't judge someone who took from somebody else in order to feed their hungry baby, I don't imagine. Even though it might look like breaking the second precept. We wouldn't judge that, I think. I wouldn't. I'd think, wow, yeah, baby is hungry. They're properly hungry, I mean, like, not just casually hungry. Hasn't eaten for 2 hours, but actually hasn't eaten for 2 days. Yeah. Take some food. So what is it to contemplate that we care? And that action moves from caring.